You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Front and center is the common approach to questioning suspects. The generally accepted gold standard, the Reed technique of interviewing and interrogation, which has been used to train more than half of the police officers in the United States, not only fails to guard against false confessions, but actually appears to encourage them. Using the Reed approach, when someone like Juan is brought in for questioning, detectives determine whether he is telling the truth through a non-confrontational interview. And then, if he appears to be lying and his guilt is reasonably certain, they proceed to an aggressive interrogation designed to extract a confession. Unfortunately, as we will explore in detail later, police officers are no better than the rest of us at detecting deceit. And far from correcting officers' erroneous intuitions about lying, the Reed technique relies heavily on unreliable gut instincts and dubious cues to deception. This means that a significant number of the people who end up being subjected to harsh interrogation phase of questioning under the Reed approach are actually innocent. Indeed, it is innocent people who are more likely to waive their rights to remain silent and to have a lawyer present in the first place. They tend to assume, as we all do, that what they themselves know to be true will also be readily evident to outsiders. Since they didn't commit the crime in question, there is little risk of talking to the police in an open way. If anything, clamming up or requesting an attorney would imply guilt. But in reality, once the interrogation phase is underway, innocence is off the table. Investigators are advised to repeatedly accuse the suspect of having committed the crime and prevent the suspect from offering denials or alternative explanations. All efforts are directed toward gaining the coveted confession. To this end, the Reed Manual heartily embraces lying about the evidence in the government's possession. If you want to get a hardened criminal to admit to a crime, you can't just play nice.
Adam Benferrato is an associate professor of law at Drexel University. He's a graduate of Yale College and Harvard Law School, and he served as a federal appellate law clerk and an attorney at Jenner and Block. His new book is Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Thank you for joining me, Adam.
It's a pleasure.
This book is about a subject that's been on the radar of neuroscientists for quite some time, and I really love your approach. You've managed to take a really logical approach to break this down into the archetypal people who are parts of the justice system. What made you decide to take that kind of approach?
Well, I really wanted to show the scope of the problem. So the book is about these hidden forces that shape the behavior of everyone in the legal system. And I thought it just made sense to look at each character individually. So I start with the victim. I then move to the detective. We talked about judges and jurors and witnesses. And in each chapter, I contrast the conventional stories that we tell about how these people make decisions and where things go wrong with what the latest evidence from psychology has to say.
This is, I hope, the beginning of a really important dialogue of among the American people about exactly how our justice system works. You suggest that the problem isn't the system, it's the people.
Yeah, and I might even add that maybe it's both of those things, because often it's people acting within situations which act as powerful constraints and encourage certain types of behavior that leads to bad outcomes and wrongful convictions. So the starting point for all of this work was really, for me, in law school, when I was, reading cases, learning from professors who, many of whom were telling me that what was important, what was moving the law, was statutory language and rules and constraints. And I was skeptical about that, and I looked for some dissenting voices on the Harvard Law School faculty who were trying to look at things in a different way. And one of the people I started working with, John Hansen, really, I think, reveal to me this entire realm of research, the mind science research, which offered a very different account of what was moving the criminal justice system. And, you know, I graduated, went off, worked for a judge, worked as a lawyer. And when I became a law professor, I really thought, well, what I want to do is be shaping these questions that the psychologists are actually looking at. And so I started working with a number of psychologists on experimental research to try to test some of these things. What actually is driving us to punish? Do attorney gestures actually matter in the courtroom, or is it determined by what attorneys say? And this work, I think, holds the key to making our system more just. I think understanding human behavior is the key to building a system that works and does the things that we want it to do.
Well, one of the things that I think the underlying principles of this book is that we are not the rational beings that we pretend or to be, hope to be, want to be, even strive to be, that our most rational, what we perceive as our most rational, hard-headed, factual-oriented decisions are instead driven by forces that we really don't understand.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think if you take one of the characters in the book that we think about as hyper-rational, right, the judge. I worked for a brilliant judge, and I have great respect for judges. And we have this idea in the United States that judges are there are basically two of kinds of them in the world, right? On the one hand, we have activist judges. On the other hand, we have these umpire judges who just call balls and strikes. And essentially that, you know, dealing with judicial bias is all about just choosing to be objective, right? You choose to be an activist. You choose to be an umpire. And what the research suggests is that all judges are biased. And they're biased in a lot of ways that are beyond their conscious awareness or control. So one of my very favorite experiments in the book, I actually looked at this question of what leads people to either be granted parole or denied parole. So I'm a law professor. I teach criminal law. The things that I would say would matter, right, are, well, what did the person do? How bad a crime was it? And how did they do in prison? Did they reform themselves? Did they get into fights, etc.? Well, that's not what was determining things, according to the researchers. What mattered was the time of day when people appeared before this panel to seek parole. If you came first thing in the morning, that was a really good time. That your chances were the highest, right, first thing in the morning. Worst time to come before the judge, right before that first break in the day. So that's something that people have been joking about, right, in law for a long time. Well, it's what the judge had for breakfast that determines the outcome. But I think for most people, that was a joke. It was nothing more. We thought what determined outcomes was the law and the books and the facts. Well, we need to look at the evidence, and the evidence suggests there are some things that we treat as irrelevant, which are determining the course of adjudication.
One of the things that experiment brings up is the import of our new ability to accumulate and process data in a statistical sense, to get stats out of what's happening in a way that we really weren't able to do before. And I think that really helps you actually get what is an objective idea of what's happening in these courts.
Yeah, and that's one of, you know, if you look at the overall themes in the book, a really big one is that we need evidence-based law. We need to collect statistics. We need the information. We need to run experiments. Now, other fields have already undergone this revolution, right? We have evidence-based medicine. Before that, doctors used to decide based on, you know, intuition, anecdote, professional feel. And then some people said, you know what? This is a bad way to deliver medicine. We should collect data. We should have robust empirical tests and figure out what works, what types of interventions, what medicine works and which doesn't. If you look at business has undergone an evidence-based revolution. Not surprising when there are billions of dollars on the line that people in business said, well, we can't just trust, right, our gut instincts here on what products to sell and how to deal with various crises that come up. We need to collect data. We need to find out what the truth is. Even sports is undergoing this revolution. But law has been slow to come out and make these changes. And I think it has largely to do with our deference to those who came before us. We tend to think that the people who are behind our legal system are founders, the learned men, and they were mostly men who came before us, somehow were more enlightened and brilliant than we are. I don't think that's true. I think they were human beings, and I think, unfortunately, they lacked the tools that we have now, which is this evidence from psychology and neuroscience. If they had had that, I think they would have made changes to their legal system, and so we now need to do that.
I think I really like your approach of, as I say, of breaking this down into the different people who are the different archetypal parts of the system, and to look at our perceptions of them and how our immediate perceptions versus our longer-term perceptions can be different. And one of the things that you really don't like is gut instinct. You're not a big fan of that, are you?
I'm not. I mean, I think that we have to rely on gut instincts, but our gut instincts can get us into trouble. And it makes sense that we would have gut instincts because sometimes in the world, you've got to make quick decisions, and those quick decisions can be the difference between life and death. And so it makes sense that we would develop these sort of automatic knowledge structures. If you think about police officers, so in writing this book, I went on ride-alongs in Philadelphia and Brooklyn. And one of the things that really struck me was, first of all, a lot of the time, it's very boring being a police officer. You're, you know, writing up endless reports about someone's stolen motorcycle and sitting waiting for something to happen. And then all of a sudden, you are in a very serious situation in which you have very limited information and have to make a quick call about how to react. When I was in Philadelphia, we were in a bad neighborhood, got a call about a domestic violence issue. We arrive at the house, and there's a man who sticks his head out of the upstairs window and says, "What do you want?" Police say, "Sir, can you come down? We heard a report of children screaming in the house." "I'm not coming down." "Sir, we need you to come downstairs." Man comes down finally, opens the door just a crack, and he says, We're just singing the alphabet." What do you do if you're an officer in that situation? You're looking through the door. You see some kids. They're not actively crying. You don't know what this guy has been doing. You don't know who's in there. You don't know what the screaming was about. And you've got to make a call in that moment. So is it surprising then that we rely on these stereotypical associations, our gut instincts, our experience? Sometimes that works really, really well. And as we have seen with over the last few months with all of these young black men shot, brutalized by police, sometimes it can get us into trouble. Now, my take on a lot of the violence that experienced by members of the African-American community is not that police forces are filled to the brim with explicit bigots. There are some people like that in police forces, and they obviously need to be removed. But I think the far bigger danger to young black men is actually well-intentioned officers who believe themselves to be completely egalitarian, who have been exposed to the same damaging, pervasive stereotypes in our society that we all have, that link blackness and crime and violence. And so when they're in that automatic, that quick response situation, they look at this person holding something in their hand and they see a gun, because they link black skin, it must be a gun. This thing I can't quite make out in the second. But if it was a white person, they would see that that was a cell phone, because that's stereotype congruent. And there's actually really great research that's been done on shooter bias that documents exactly this problem, right? That we're more apt to link blacks and violence, blacks and crimes. We're more likely to see that black man in that ambiguous circumstance as a threat. And so I think to address this, right, it's not about getting rid of automatic reactions. That's going to be very hard to do. I think it's about getting rid of these particularly damaging associations and learning, if we can't get rid of them, how to control that behavior.
It seems, too, that lurking in the background of this book are the vast cultural accumulation of crime fiction, TV shows that inform us that cops are constantly shooting, they're constantly investigating, and that any crime can be solved in an hour.
Yeah, I think that those expectations that come, I mean, I am a cop, true crime, television junkie. I will admit it. I do love all of these shows that probably many listeners enjoy too. But I do sometimes have to walk into the other room. My wife will tell you that sometimes I can't quite stand it. And it's because a lot of these shows reinforce, I think, really damaging ideas, not just about police officers, but about lawyers and judges and evidence. And that's really scary. So, I mean, I think that these shows suggest, for instance, that eyewitness identifications, when an eyewitness comes forward and says, well, that's the guy, that's a really good way to be sure we got the right guy and send him away. And what the best research available suggests now is actually eyewitnesses get it wrong quite a lot of the time. So one of the cases that I talk about in the book, which to me was one of the most startling moments in my research, was I came across this photograph from 1979, Meriwether County, Georgia. And it's this image of a lineup. So there's brutal rape had happened, and the victim was brought in. She looked at these five guys, and she said, yep, that one right in the middle, John Jerome White. So John Jerome White is convicted, goes to prison for something like 2 decades. Well, remember, this was 1979. 2 decades later, they actually contest the biological evidence, which was saved. He wasn't the guy. Now, what was so startling about this image for me was it's not just that they got the wrong guy. It's that the right guy was in that original lineup.
And he conformed to her original description of him.
Exactly. And yet, this woman looked at this true perpetrator, who she'd been eye to eye with, and picked out the guy standing 2 people next to him. And to me, this shows that good, well-intentioned people who have every incentive to get it right, get it wrong. And so we need to understand, well, if we believe that eyewitness identifications are a really good way to convict people, and they're not, well, where do we go from there? I think the answer is, first of all, we probably shouldn't charge as many people as we do. Tens of thousands of people are charged this, you know, every year based on eyewitness identifications. But we know that in real eyewitness identifications, about a third of the time, a person picks out an innocent filler. That's a terrible rate of error. Right? Unacceptable. I mean, we wouldn't accept that. Even with our cars, we wouldn't accept that if, you know, seatbelts failed one third of the time or something like that. That obviously is a really, really big concern. And I think the other thing that we need to really think about is, you know, ways that we can not rely on eyewitness identifications so much. You know, there was a murder near where I live in Philadelphia, and it was closed not because eyewitnesses came forward, but because of surveillance videotape in downtown Philadelphia managed to pick out the person's license plate. And so we never had to rely on faulty human memory. We need to look for other ways that we can get around some of these human limitations.
One of the things I really like is the way you kind of this book allows us to pull our perceptions away from the norm. At the very, very beginning of the book, you describe a trial conducted with the utmost science, the latest cutting edge of complete impartiality that involved, like, finding out if the witch would float.
Right. So, you know, as I was thinking about how can I bring home where we are today, right, and allow people to look at where we are today with this new set of eyes. So I thought, you know what? Why don't we look at something that happened 900 years ago, which now seems absolutely absurd to us, and yet to the people who were living there, seemed like a truly just and logical legal system, this idea of trial by ordeal. When you didn't have, say, witnesses against the people or any hard evidence, how could you tell, right, whether someone was a heretic or not. It's very difficult. There's a problem which is still with us today when we don't have much evidence. How do we decide guilt or innocence? And for people living at that time who believed in God's power to control the natural elements, it seemed totally rational that what we would do would be we'd submerge someone in water, water that was pure. And pure water would expel someone who was guilty and accept someone who was innocent. So
makes perfect sense.
Exactly,
it's
to
scientific.
Those people. But now, you know, it's the makings of Monty Python, right? We can laugh about it. My conjecture is that people 900 years in the future are going to look back at our current legal system and see it as farce, just as we see tossing someone in water to determine their guilt as farce. That's hard for people to accept. But again, you know, I try to build that argument in the 300 pages of the book to convince people that there are problems that are, you know, things about our legal system that are just as illogical, just as faulty.
You start out with the victim and you give us a picture of perfect, where our gut instincts should be operating perfectly. There's an inebriated man. He's lying in the street. He's kind of looks like he's drunk. He smells bad. He looks bad.
Yeah.
Must be a drunk.
Yeah. So this is a story that was really, I actually just gave a talk at Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C., two blocks from where this incident happened. Very nice suburb. So this guy, Jerry, walks out of his house late at night. There's a body lying on the ground. He goes up and, you know, the man's kind of moaning, trying to get up, but unable to speak. So, you know, Jerry's wife calls the fire engine. Fire engine comes around the block. As soon as the firefighters get out, as you suggest, the man vomits. And one of those firefighters says, must just be a drunk. I smell alcohol. So when the police arrive, right, just a drunk, they keep to the periphery. When the EMTs arrive, they say, what? We came all this way just for a drunk. They kind of throw the guy in the back. They don't go to the closest hospital, which is required by protocol. They go to the one that's a little bit closer to where the crew leader lives so she can run some errands. After all, it's just a drunk. When they get to the hospital, just a drunk. So they put him in the hallway to sleep it off. And this is how everything goes until all of a sudden, one of the nurses walks by and notices this man is breathing in a very strange manner. Kind of this snarl. So she gives him a sternum rub, and his arms and legs flip inward, which is a sign not of drunkenness, but of a head injury. It turns out this is no drunk. This is David Rosenbaum, an award-winning New York Times reporter. And he dies. And I think what is so interesting about this case is, well, once we know this is David Rosenbaum, suddenly we act very differently. And we look at, well, what actually happened here? Well, David had dinner with his wife, gone out for a brisk air walk after dinner, been hit in the head with a bar by two guys who were robbing him. So why did this happen? Why all of these mistakes that led to David's death? Well, I think it has to do with how we quickly sum up victims. We attach this label, drunk, and then everything else is filtered through that label. Labels are very sticky, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we may sum someone up based on the smell on their breath, their skin color, whether they appear rich or poor, whether they're young or old. And those labels end up affecting the entire trajectory of a case. So there was plenty of evidence actually out there that didn't align with this model that this was just a homeless drunk, right? David's back pocket had been ripped out. He was wearing, again, a homeless drunk, but he's wearing a nice watch and a wedding ring.
Mm-hmm.
And yet with this frame of drunkenness, right, all of that other counter evidence is totally missed. If they'd actually looked at this man's dilated pupils, if you looked at all of his symptoms, it didn't align with a drunkenness label. But no one ever checked. They just took the label, passed it on to the next party. And unfortunately, this affects not just firefighters and EMTs and all these folks. It affects forensic lab technicians. So we know from experiments that if someone who is doing a DNA, trying to match up, say, a fingerprint or a DNA sample, if they're told, well, this sample comes from someone who, you know, we confessed to the crime, or someone for whom we have a couple of eyewitnesses. That forensic lab technician is significantly more likely to say, yep, we got a match, than when he or she isn't provided with that information. So if our most objective, seemingly most objective evidence can be susceptible to confirmation bias, we've got to start being very concerned.
You just said a phrase that hangs heavy over this book and, in fact, is a dark cloud over our entire justice system. What does confirmation bias mean precisely? And talk about how it plays out, well, for example, in the world of the detective.
Well, I think a lot of times all different people sort of have an idea of, they have a theory, right, about a person. They have an idea about what the answer to some question is. And that pre-existing notion ends up acting sort of as tunnel vision, which allows a person to sort of, when they come across evidence that goes against that theory, rather than revisiting that initial assumption, they tend to just disregard it or downplay it or bend it a little bit so that it fits, right? And they go selectively looking for evidence that actually matches up. And this affects, you know, obviously forensic examiners. It can matter for detectives. As detectives, kind of once they have an assumption of guilt, they then look for other evidence that matches up. But it also affects judges and even Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. There's really interesting research that's just been done in the last couple of years looking at when Supreme Court justices look for legislative facts about the case.
So this is so interesting.
Yeah. So you would think Supreme Court justices, you know, I know a number of my good friends have clerked on the Supreme Court, and these are brilliant people. And I think the Supreme Court justices are brilliant people. And so you'd think, well, when they have some question that they want to answer, right, like how dangerous are police chases or something like that, they would go and survey all of the evidence out there, sort of look at it as a whole, sort through, determine how solid different studies are based on their methodology, and then reach the logical conclusion. But what the research shows about how people, Supreme Court justices and their clerks, do research is essentially they start with some idea. Well, police chases are dangerous. That's what I want to find. And then they just go to Google, like we all do, and find, surprise, surprise, some studies that suggest that. And if you look at what gets cited in, you know, Supreme Court opinions, it's not the best research available. It's the research that conveniently fits what Supreme Court justices already believe to be true. And that's one reason that I really think we would do better with some sort of independent research entity that could help Supreme Court justices provide to all of the justices the same set of information. Would that still introduce some biases? Yes, I think so. But it would at least avoid this sort of self-serving confirmation bias that we're already undergoing.
You make a number of really interesting suggestions in this book, and I definitely want to get to some of them. But one of the things that interested me was you cite a lot of research in this book, and I was wondering, where did you learn about this research? And when you were researching this book, did you have to check yourself to avoid your own kind of confirmation bias?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that's a really hard thing for all authors, right, is we're making arguments, mm-hmm. right? And you always have certain notions of what you believe to be true. And I think one of the things that I tried to do was collect the data first before writing. I mean, I know different law professors, how some write and how I write. Some authors honestly write up like a law review article with no footnotes yet. And then they go looking for the evidence mm-hmm. and then fill in the footnotes afterwards. I think that's a really bad way to do it because, of course, you can always find evidence to support. I mean, there is access to so much information now. You can always find someone doing something that backs up what you think. I think the better approach is to look at the evidence first, look at it all, figure out what are the good studies, and then build your argument from there. That's what I tried to do in this book. Is it perfect? I doubt it. But again, I tried to adopt the best sort of practice that I could going forward. Now, as you point out, the most difficult thing with writing this book is each chapter engages completely different research from psychology and neuroscience, as well as research, you know, on police officer behavior and judicial behavior. And so the short answer is, the way I managed it was by taking 4 years of my life and torturing my family, and it was a real challenge. This book was twice as long when I turned in the first draft, and with a very dedicated editor, we cut and we cut and we cut down. And you know, I think now that was a terrible process. I won't lie; it was one of the most painful years of editing that I've experienced in my life. But my goal always, I could have written an academic press book. I am an academic after all. That was the logical thing to do. But I just became convinced that this stuff was just too important. It was people's lives were being ruined. There were too many people out there who'd experienced the crooked nightstick of the law, and that we needed change, and we needed it now. And so the only way to do that, I think, was bringing these stories to everyone, right? I did not write this book just for lawyers and judges. I would love those people to read this book, but I want everyone to read this book and to get angry and to get excited about reform. And I couldn't have imagined, right, what would happen. I mean, I started this book a long time ago. I've been thinking about these ideas for way longer. I've been doing experimental research with psychologists for way longer. I couldn't have imagined, right, that the last few months would bring this really, I think, rare moment in our nation's history where people actually seem open to change. Open, and not just minor change, I mean radical change, locking up way, way fewer people than we do, changing police practices, changing how prosecutors handle evidence. I'm hopeful that we can mark a path forward with meaningful reform, but I am scared that something's going to come up, you know, in the next few weeks, which is going to just shift our attention elsewhere. Ebola's going to come back, or there's going to be a terrorist attack, or something which is going to distract our attention. The media actually has been amazingly focused on these criminal justice stories, and I think that's the only way to force change is when we keep putting these images in front of the public until the public finally takes the message and thinks, I will not, as an American, I will not stand for this anymore.
I think one of the things this does is that you do such a great job of changing our perceptions. For example, when you talk about the suspect, you brought up something that I'd never ever thought of before, which was the mugshot genre. I never had thought of that even as a photographic genre, but you point out there's books of mugshot photographs, and that mugshot idea really changes our perception of the suspect.
Yeah, so I have always been fascinated by mugshots, and I actually include some in the book. And I think there's something about, you know, when a horrible crime has been committed, we all want to look at the face of the person as mm-hmm. if we want to somehow see the criminal behind the mask, or somehow the notion that, well, I'll be able to recognize evil when I look upon it. And so I actually started doing research on this long history of trying to detect criminality by the shape of a person's nose, the makeup of their ear, how far set apart their eyes were, the structure of their skull. And what's interesting is that this entire, you know, approach was largely a failure. And yet we still are sort of stuck with, it's sort of a metaphor, but with this very paper-thin, a surface-level notion of what criminality really is, what causes people to be a crime. We have this idea that, you know, some people are just evil, mm-hmm. or they have bad dispositions, they're greedy, they they commit crimes just to serve their own ends. And so character flaws. And I started to do a lot of research, and I'd been looking at this issue actually since law school, trying to understand why people commit crimes. And what I found was, really, most crime can be explained, and you know, we're still working on building the evidence here. It's a long-term process. But I think eventually we will basically find out that most crime can just be explained by what we refer to as interior situation, the makeup of your brain, and exterior situation, your environment. So when it comes to interior situation, we're just learning more and more about how brain deficiencies are linked to criminal behavior, right? So when people have actually noticeable problems in, say, their prefrontal cortex and areas of the brain which relate to impulse control problems, unsurprisingly, they get into trouble with the law more often. And if you look at the numbers, people who have experienced traumatic brain injury are way disproportionately represented in our prisons.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, to me, when you start to think about that fact, the idea of personal responsibility, right, that these are evil people or these people have chosen to commit crimes, starts to break down a little bit, right? We start to think, well, if it matters being exposed to heavy metals as a kid and that increases your chances of becoming a criminal and you later become a criminal, why do we treat that person so harshly? And the person who was never exposed to metals, we say, good job for you, right? You chose to be a noble person. I think that's deeply problematic. Now, that's interior situation. When you start to look at exterior situation, I mean, it's really amazing the types of things that can encourage people to engage in pretty bad behavior. So I imagine a lot of listeners are familiar with the Stanley Milgram experiments from the 1960s, right? You bring in a cross-section of people from New Haven, Connecticut, bring them into a laboratory, and tell them that they're going to take part in an experiment where they're going to be delivering shocks to a learner to teach the person to learn better. Every time the person gets a mistake, you're supposed to increase the voltage by 15 volts or something like that. So you go into the experiment, things start going, person starts making errors, you increase 15 volts. At some point along that spectrum, it goes all the way up to 450 volts, the person starts screaming out in pain, saying, I want out of this, saying that they're experiencing heart problems. At some point along that spectrum, the person actually goes silent. So what proportion of people, again, these are just broad sections, what proportion of people would do that? Well, when they surveyed, right, the broader population, people thought, oh, 1 out of 100. I think experts thought 1 out of 1,000. It's only the sadists would ever deliver horrible pain to a knowing person when they didn't have to do that. But the number was something like 60% of people or something like that went forward with the experiment all the way to 450 volts. And you think about that, right? These are good people. This is a experiment that was very controversial. I think a lot of the controversy came from the fact that it told us something about ourselves that we don't want to acknowledge, which is that we're probably all capable of doing pretty bad things, doing criminal actions. I think that's difficult, based on human psychology, to accept. We want to see the people that we lock up as fundamentally different than us.
We're all about a paycheck away from crime.
I think that's true. I think it's little things in life that change, the paths that we follow. And I think, one of the things that I push forward, and a controversial argument in the book, is that we need to really rethink whether a blame-based system of criminal justice is in our best interests at all, or whether we want to go to something that looks a lot more like a public health model that's focusing on rehabilitation, that's focusing on making the victim whole again, right? We don't ask the victim, what do you need to heal in this current regime, right? victims are just trotted out. They're almost like special evidence, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly.
Well, here, you know, at trial, we bring the person out and we parade them, and the person, hopefully, you know, the victim cries, and then we wheel them back out and we get our conviction. That is a bad way of doing things, right? Why not say, what has this experience been like for you as a victim, and what do you need? Other countries are actually experimenting with this restorative justice idea, where a lot of times someone's experienced, say, being robbed at gunpoint. Is the best thing for them to lock up that person who has pointed a gun at them? Well, maybe for some people, but for a lot of people, it actually may be helpful to sit down with that person and talk to them and ask them any questions that you want to ask them, to get an apology, to find out that actually there was nothing special about you or bad about you that made you the victim here. In fact, it was a random situation, to understand why this person even did it. We don't ask those type of questions. We don't present those opportunities. I think that if we did, we could go a lot further down the line to being that idealistic society that we want to be.
You advocate what I would call maybe an instant karma style of punishment, and where justice is swift, imprisonment is swift and short, based something along the models of Norway, what Norway is doing.
Yeah. So I look at the evidence on deterrence.
Mm-hmm. This is really fascinating.
Yeah.
Too.
And then,
the stats
then I,
are
yeah.
Great.
And then I look at what our country actually does, right? So we get everything wrong in terms of the psychological evidence on deterrence, right? So anyone who has, say, a dog knows that if you wait to punish the dog, like several hours after the dog has already, say, pooped on the rug, right? Not going to be all that effective a deterrent. You've got to catch the dog, right, peeing at the moment or whatever the dog is doing, and, you know, discipline the dog at that moment. But think about our criminal justice system. In areas of this country, sometimes people's trial isn't for 300 days, 400 days, 500 days. They haven't even gone to trial yet. One of the other things we know about deterrence is it's got to be very certain that you will receive whatever the sanction is. If it's uncertain, right, it's not going to serve as a very good sanction at all. But in this country, there's all of this variability. Chances are, you know, your chances if you commit a burglary that you'll even be caught is fairly low. Chances that you'll actually be prosecuted, even lower. Chances that you'll be convicted. So it's very uncertain. And another thing that needs to happen in order for effective deterrence is people need to know what the penalty actually is going to be. But of course, many people don't know. Our criminal code is incredibly complex. There's all of these enhancements and mitigating factors. So most criminals don't even know what the likely consequences will be. And if you look at other countries, and even at some pilot programs in the United States that focus on ensuring that people, right, are being closely monitored, particularly people who are on, say, parole, right, that they're constantly being monitored and that they know that one slip up will bring punishment, swift punishment. The punishment doesn't actually have to be that severe. It could just be, you know, for a drug offender, regular drug tests, and any mistake, you get picked up by the sheriff and you get taken to jail for 2 or 3 days. Hawaii has tried just such an issue, just such an approach, and it's been tremendously successful. It's now being tried in other areas of the country. So I think, you know, if you look specifically at Norway, one of the things I really like about Norway is that their entire system of corrections is focused on rehabilitation. Other countries in Northern Europe, similarly, it's actually written into their law, right? Our primary focus is not on, say, deterring people or incapacitating people. It's on rebuilding people who have made very bad mistakes in society. So one of the facilities that I focus on in the book is this Halden prison in Norway, which houses rapists and murderers. And yet, if you look at the way they treat the people, you know, the prison warden there you know, has said, well, why would we create monstrous conditions? Monstrous conditions produce monsters. We know these people are going to be back in society. So what we should be doing is creating better people. The people that we send out into the world after being in our prison should be better people. What does that mean? Well, that means training them for jobs. That means maintaining connections with family members. That means thinking about what they did and how to repair the harm that they did. Prison workers in Norway are a lot more like social workers. Mm-hmm. In the United States, we focus a lot more on hiring tough people, right? Who can almost, stand the brutal conditions, who are hardened, who, can deliver harsh justice.
Are worse than the people that are incarcerating almost.
In some situations, yes. And that's just a losing strategy. I mean, when you think about it on those terms, most of the people that we are putting in solitary confinement, most of the people that we're putting in these, brutal conditions within prisons, where your choices are basically, join one of these gangs or fight it out on your own. Those people are going to be back inside of our communities. Why deprive them of the things that they need to be successful? But that's what we do. So when the people come out, right, they've lost connections with their family. They don't have any skills. They've lost any connection to the job world. And indeed, in most circumstances, employers do background checks. I think it's something like 4 out of 5companies now do background checks on people. And if you come up as a felon, you're not getting a job anyway. We don't provide oftentimes social services. If you're a felon, you can't get social services from the government, and you're denied the right to vote. So is it any surprise that in states in the United States, some states, it's 60% of people commit crimes again? It's hard to compare between countries, some of these statistics, but we know Norway is much, much lower when it comes to recidivism rates. And I don't think that's a surprise based on the approach they take.
One of the things you suggest, and it makes a terrifying amount of sense, is that the decrease in crime we've seen over the past couple of decades has just been a relocation of crime from the streets to the prisons.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a shocking idea, but it suddenly starts to make sense. Well, we've incarcerated a huge number of people, and yay, our crime rates have gone down. So it looks like, well, we solved the problem. But then you look at the crime rates within prisons. What's so bizarre here, right, is these are places which we say are, we're in total control. And yet we have lots of murders happen in prisons. Rape is endemic in prisons. Thousands and thousands of people experience sexual assaults in our prisons.
It's almost a guarantee.
It is. And I think, that relates to something else that I talk about in the book, which is what we think our punishment system actually does versus what, we think it does. So one of the things is, maybe if it doesn't deter people, which is our primary goal, it doesn't necessarily make it safer. Well, at least we're delivering, deserved payback to the worst of the worst people. But look at who gets particularly brutalized in prison. Is it the worst of the worst people?
No, they're on the brutalizing end.
No, they're the people who do the brutalizing.
Exactly.
It's young people, right? It's that 18-year-old or it's that 16-year-old locked up at Rikers awaiting trial who gets brutalized, who gets raped. It's people who are particularly small. It's people who are gay. So it's actually the most vulnerable population. Often it's nonviolent offenders, people locked up for, say, a drug crime. Those are the people who get raped, who get beaten up, not the worst of the worst people. So we need to revisit, right, these reasons why we send people to prison, because we've gotten them wrong.
You suggest that our perception of guns and the way they are used is upside down. I thought that was a really interesting discussion in this book.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that are interesting, I think, about the psychology of guns. One of the things that we think about guns is that basically we're all rational people, and sometimes we have bad events involving guns because, there are some bad apples among us who pick out guns and use them for their bad ends, right? And those people, if we didn't have guns, well, they'd go and get a knife, or they'd drive their car over someone, or they'd do something else. Well, one of the things cool about the research, cool and frightening about the research, is the gun actually can have more of a causal impact on people's behavior. So in experiments, the very act of holding a gun changes our perceptions. When we're holding a gun, we're more likely to see guns or expect guns in other people's hands just by holding the gun.
So that cop out there holding a gun, looking at a kid holding a cell phone, he's more likely to see a gun just by virtue of the fact he has one.
That's what the research suggests. And so I talk again about, you know, wearing a mask even, right? The fact that we think that bad people, criminals, wear masks, right, in order to pursue their bad ends. And yet there's research that suggests that the mask itself can change how people act. The very act of putting on a mask does the work.
That you did. The research is so great that it was done with kids.
Yeah, right. So this was a famous set of experiments looking at kids in Halloween costumes and looking at the behavior of children when they were wearing masks or not wearing masks in terms of dishonesty, cheating, bad behavior. More recently, there's been interesting work on dishonesty with designer glasses that are either fake or real glasses. And when people believe that they're wearing fake glasses, that actually encourages dishonest behavior. So these things that we think are just, you know, our clothing, something that we're, handling in our hands, those things are actually influencing our behavior beyond our conscious awareness.
We are absolutely not the rational actors we hope to be, pretend to be, or even that the rules tell us to be when the rules are being spoken to us in a court of law for the jury.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that worries me. I mean, I have always tried to get on juries. I teach criminal law. I worked for a judge, and so I've always been very interested to see that perspective, to be inside the jury room. And I always get kicked off because no one wants a law professor. No prosecutor, defense attorney wants a law professor on a jury. And one of the things, though, the last time that I got called in Philadelphia that was just so upsetting to me was how we handle juror bias. So basically, anyone who's listening who's ever been on a jury, you know, you get a questionnaire and ask you questions like, is there any reason that you would be more or less likely to believe the testimony of a police officer? So on the jury I was on, a couple of people said, yes, there is a reason why I would be more or less likely. So what did the judge do in those circumstances? Well, the judge said, well, let me explain the idea of objectivity to you. That means that, you know, you have these feelings, but you've just got to put them to the side and control yourself. Can you do that? Everyone who checked that box said, yep. All right, Judge, now I understand. Yes, I can do that. But that's not what the evidence says. We can't just flip on these switches on and off in our brains. We can't do that. Same thing with, prejudicial evidence, right? So some bit of testimony, some evidence is entered in, and then there's an objection. The judge decides, no, that can't come in. But it's already appeared before a jury. Well, the jury is then told, all right, disregard what you've just heard. Well, we know that doesn't work. In fact, even judges are not able to turn that off. Once they've seen something, once they know some detail about a defendant, that affects how they decide a case. And I find, you know, it's not just that the legal system is ignorant of all of these hidden forces that are shaping behavior. It actually encourages an incorrect set of assumptions about what bias is and how you control it.
Well, it's like telling somebody, don't think of the word elephant.
yeah, exactly.
Now, you make some really fascinating suggestions in this book for solutions to our problems, things that we could begin to implement now. And first and foremost, you say we need to get rid of in-court eyewitness identification. Why?
Yeah, so I actually, when I was a law clerk, I was clerking on the D.C. Circuit, so we don't get very many criminal law cases. But I did get one popped up before my judge, and it was one that involved multiple identifications. And this really got me interested in this research. I started reading quite a lot about it. And I was really shocked that we allow multiple identifications. So, you know, imagine a scenario, someone robs a bank or something. Someone's brought in, cops arrive, and, you know, they find someone a couple blocks away, handcuff him, sit him down on, you know, the sidewalk. And then they bring one of the people who was in the bank by in the squad car. And they say, oh, you see the person who committed the bank robbery? And the person says, oh, yeah, you mean the guy sitting handcuffed on the, you know, side of the road? So, again, that's very suggestive procedure. That's called a show up. We should really only use those in really dire circumstances, right, where there's a murderer on the loose and we need to decide, right, how to allocate police resources or something. In a lot of things like this, there's no urgent need to do a show up. Now, in a case like this, it's quite common to then have that same witness come back 2 weeks later to do, say, a live lineup down at the station. So the question with a live lineup when the person picks out that same man from the sitting on the sidewalk is, well, is that person remembering the guy from the bank robbery, or is she remembering the guy she saw sitting on the stoop, right? We don't know because we've already corrupted the memory. Then, you know, maybe it's 5 months later, we have the actual trial. And that same eyewitness stands up and says, yep, I see the man who robbed that bank. He's sitting right there at the table. So from a jury's perspective, it's like, well, she's 3 for 3. And in court, she says she's 100% certain. But those second two identifications are worthless, essentially, right? Because who knows? She may just be remembering the person she saw sitting on the sidewalk. And if the police got the wrong guy and handcuffed the wrong guy and sat him down on that sidewalk, it's very likely that we're going to get a wrongful conviction. So I think, at the very least, we should get rid of the in-court identification at all. It makes for good drama. It makes for good TV in particular, Law and Order. You know, that's the kicker moment in the episode. But that makes for bad justice. It's dramatic, but it's not accurate. So I think we should just get rid of that. And I think we should strictly constrain how we use some of these other procedures.
You also suggest something very interesting, the virtual courtroom.
Yeah. So in the book, I focus on things that we can do right now, right? Mm-hmm. Things that certain jurisdictions are already trying to do and that other jurisdictions need to race to enact right away. And then I also focus on things that we have to have our eye on 50 years, 100 years, 500 years in the future. One of these things that I lay out is this idea that perhaps we should move away from live trials to something, a format that, in which we can better control some of these biases. So we know that attractive witnesses are more likely to be believed. We're starting to understand how attorneys' gestures can influence juror perceptions. We know how certain ways of speaking can be more effective than other ways. We know skin color of the defendant can matter. So one of the thoughts I had was, well, what if we controlled all of those things by using sort of a virtual courtroom in which people sort of presented things through avatars? We're doing similar things with respect to business transactions. The technology exists today. Could we think about, in the decades to come, using such processes going forward, using a controlled situation like this, we'd actually be able to, we were just talking about, right, how when evidence is kept away from a jury, right, it ends up impermissibly affecting how they view a case. Well, if we adopted a virtual courtroom, we could actually adopt a time delay so that when evidence was then, you know, objected to and the objection was sustained, it would never, ever be actually presented before a jury. Why not do that? Well, there are some constitutional issues, certainly. I'm the first to acknowledge them. But I don't think they're insurmountable. constitutional objections. We already allow some testimony, some hearings to be conducted when people aren't in the same room. And if people are able to do heart surgery without being in the same room, a doctor being in the same room, I think our legal system could actually also stand to take this, what seems like now a radical move, and move to virtual adjudication.
I've been speaking with Adam Benferrato. His new book is Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Thank you for joining me, Adam.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.